could have danced all night. I could have danced all night and still have begged for more. I could have spread my wings and done a thousand things I've never done before. I'll never know what made it so.
Marnie Nixon has appeared on Broadway and on concert and opera stages throughout her 7-decade-long career, but she's best known for roles in which audiences never saw her face. Marnie was the voice behind Deborah Carr, Natalie Wood, and Audrey Hepburn in the movie versions of The King and I, West Side Story, and My Fair Lady. She wrote an autobiographical look at her long and distinguished career called I Could Have Sung All Night, My Story. It's published by Billboard Books, and she's being honored with a special tribute at the Film Forum tonight. I'm pleased both of those things have brought Marnie Nixon back to the show. It's always a pleasure to see you, Marnie.
Thank you.
Time magazine dubbed you the ghostest with the mostest. And in your book, you write that ghosting, the term used for the kind of work you did, dubbing other actresses in movie musicals, threatened to turn you into a ghost. How so?
Well, of course, they thought that, of course, if you did some ghost work like that, that probably you weren't really appearing on stage, and that meant that something was probably wrong with you. You know, like you were too fat or ugly or cross-eyed or something like that.
So you couldn't get some work. But also, doesn't it cause another problem? The studios don't see you as a key factor in the film. And they're paying you the same way that they would pay a studio musician.
Right, yes. It was, in those days, I don't think it was known that there was that much dubbing going on. And I don't think they realized that because they were doing these major musicals, that the person that was doing the dubbing was that important to the whole thing.
In fact, it was kept secret, wasn't it? Because they didn't really want people to know, the audience to know, that the singing wasn't being done by the star.
Right. And I had to sign things that of course, prevented me from saying that, except that I realized over the years that people began to know it and they began to be interested in the fact that this was happening. And it didn't take away the value of the picture. You know, that didn't mean that people weren't going to see the picture because it was dubbed. And, of course, that's what the studio was worried about, that if they found out it was dubbed, that it was not real. But then it just, you know, all that inside information of the technicalities of putting films together became an interesting part of the industry. And so it gradually... I was threatened that I wouldn't work again, but if anybody knew, but other people said it for me, so I was lucky.
And we'll get to that, how Deborah Carr spilled the beans and then other things happened. But I want to go back to your beginnings. I said 7 decades. You do not look 7 decades old enough, but that's because you started incredibly young. Your sister has compared your mother to Mama Rose, was she? When you saw Gypsy, did you say, gee, that's just like my mom?
No, not quite. No,
you didn't turn out to become a stripper either.
No, that's true. my mother was very, she was a taskmaster. She was German and German-Polish descent. My father was Scottish, and he was kind of the one who lightened up everything and had the wonderful sense of humor. She was very disciplined, and we had to learn instruments, and that was just what we did. But it was a lot of fun, and then I started doing acting just to pay for my instrumental lessons.
You were a violinist.
Yes.
How serious were you?
Well, I wanted to be a concert performer of violin all my life until I started to getting into the acting and I thought this is fun, and then I thought, gee, I don't have to practice so much, and which is a fallacy because you realize you have to work just as hard but in another way. But it seemed to be more personal, and as I got more jobs that way, I realized that I had a talent for that, and so I gradually stopped practicing my instrument, which was made my mother mad. But then when I was doing other things to make up for it, and then when I got into my teenage years, I was doing my own thing and getting credit for it and getting some money for that. So she had to kind of relax a little.
Did playing the violin help you as a singer?
Oh, my gosh. I think when you're a singer, you really have to be a complete performer to be successful. I mean, learning to read music immediately, learning to get to the music, learning to then do it personally with your voice. I think that the discipline of the practicing really helps, and the knowledge of music, and then it becomes like a part of your fabric. Then you can go on to the acting part, and I think it was very valuable.
Did any of your three sisters go into the business?
No, although we had a family orchestra. My younger sister, Ariel Whitbeck, she's a cello teacher in Danville, California. We all sang together. We had a trio. My older sister didn't want to sing. There were four of us, but we had a trio for a while. And then we sort of got into our own thing. My older sister went into education, and the oldest one went into design. She played the clarinet, and then my next older sister played the piano, the bells, and drums, and she taught for a while. But she started teaching reading, and so we all branched out into our own things.
Well, how old were you when you appeared in your first film? It was in 1937, wasn't it?
I think so.
What were you doing there? How did you wind up in the films?
Well, we were in Los Angeles. That's where we were born and raised. And I think what happened there was an orchestra, Peter Marenbloom Jr. Symphony Orchestra, and these little kids. I think I was about, six or seven when I started playing with that orchestra. And because a lot of the people in the Hollywood industry then, the producers and directors were all Europeans, and they came to see Marenbloom, who was this refugee from Russia, and what he had done with these young kids and his orchestra. And then I began to stand up from the violin section and sing a few songs with my own orchestra, and some of those producers would be there at our rehearsal sessions. And so then we got the idea that maybe we could go to the studios and we could be extras just to make money for our lessons.
So did you ever get a speaking role?
Well, eventually I did. I got some bit parts, and then it sort of developed from there. And the dubbing, of course, was just a part of that, came along a little later, still during my teens, but gradually when I got to be 20, I guess. No, I think my first dubbing I must have done maybe when I was 16 or 17. I was working as a messenger girl at MGM, and Bronnie Caper, who was a composer who wrote Lily and a lot of famous movies and wrote the scores for those, was at the orchestra and had heard me sing and saw me on the lot on the MGM stage, at the MGM studios. And he said, "Hey, Nixon, you think you're so smart? You think you can come and sing for somebody?" And I said, "Well, sure, why not?" And he said, "Can you sing in Hindu?" And I said, "Oh, sure, why not?" I mean, I was a big faker. I mean, how did I know I could sing in Hindu? But I thought I could do anything, And so we went into the studio, and they had this Swami there who taught me this Hindu speaking thing, and it was for Margaret O'Brien, and she was doing a little lullaby.
And Margaret O'Brien couldn't sing the part herself?
No, so that was my first dubbing job. And anyway,
you mentioned a man named Muzzy Marcellino in the opening of your book. He did a lot of dubbing in those days?
Yes. He was a prominent musician and performer of various things, and Oh, gosh, those names. I have to sift through my myriads of meandering minds here.
But these were all invisible people at the time. And there was even a time when you did some work for Marilyn Monroe.
Yes.
Early in her career.
Yes. Well, Breakfast at Tiffany's. Or Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend.
Yeah, that Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. That's, yes. No, so, Breakfast at Tiffany's, that's right. That was Audrey Hepburn.
But so you sang for Marilyn Monroe, who was known as a singer.
Well, she wasn't. She had a certain kind of a voice that sometimes it didn't have the extension of some of the high notes, and they needed somebody to do the high notes. So that's what I did.
And was it okay with these people?
Sometimes they didn't know until after the picture was out.
Although in the case of The King and I, Deborah Carr actually worked well with you. Didn't
oh,
she?
Well, in The King and I we actually, she was in much agreement with the fact that she needed to be dubbed. And we worked a week per song before we even recorded them. And then it was her job to then mouth to that recording. So we were quite together, and I knew every little movement we rehearsed on the sound stage with the rehearsal stage with the furniture all laid out and just rehearsed side by side till we got a blend, and she could approve of that.
And no one was supposed to know. But
right.
she spilled the beans?
Yes. Yeah, she went here to Earl Wilson and gave an interview, and the head of the headline was Deborah Tells a Secret. And I said to her, look, the people aren't supposed to know that I did your dubbing. And she said, well, I don't have to know that that's in your contract. I mean, she was that gracious. She was wonderful.
My guest is Marnie Nixon, who's told her story in a book called I Could Have Sung All Night, with a foreword by Marilyn Horne. I'm assuming you've never had to dub for Marilyn Horne.
She did some dubbing herself.
You'll also be honored with a special tribute tonight at the Film Forum. So you're finally getting real recognition for the work that you've done. What were some of the other films? Everybody knows West Side Story and My Fair Lady. In West Side Story, you sang not just Natalie Wood's part, but also
a portion of Rita Moreno's part in one ensemble where the dubber Betty Wand, who was dubbing for Rita, had a cold, and Rita did too on the day of the recording. And so they said, hey, Marnie, you know, you think you're so smart, you can do anything. Can you do her voice too? So I said, sure. And so,
well, but here you are. You did Deborah Carr and Audrey Hepburn, who both have British accents. And then you did these two singers who were doing Puerto Rican accents in West Side Story. So it involved acting as well?
Well, my gosh.
How
yes,
much did you have to adjust?
Acting is just a part of the whole performing thing. Well, you have to technically kind of know how to wrap your voice around those kind of accents, and you have to just practice that, and you have to get their particular accents the way they were going to speak it in the picture. Now, I don't know whether Natalie Wood's accent was really authentic. You couldn't just learn that from a teacher. You had to learn it from her, the way she would speak it. So,
she would have liked to have done her own singing in that.
Yes.
And and Audrey Hepburn definitely seems to have really been upset when she wasn't allowed to do her own singing.
Well, she was upset, but she also accepted that I was there to help her through some of the things that she knew she couldn't do. But then she thought she could do more than she could. In the end, they had to. She recorded Wouldn't It Be Lovely to her own track, and then they had to throw that all out, and I had to come back after the fact and lay that in.
Now, you were doing at the same time. You were developing your own career. You've done opera, TV, Broadway, done commercial jingles, you've taught. Was doing this ghosting just a way to pay the bills?
Sure. I mean, that was when I was young. I mean, 100 years ago. No, it was just a way to pay the bills. It was better than doing chorus work, which I was doing all the time, which I loved. I was in classical world, I was part of the voices of Walter Schumann, and then before that the Roger Wagner Chorale.
And you've worked with Igor Stravinsky.
Yes.
You've worked with Leonard Bernstein, Aaron Copland, Liberace, of course. you've appeared on Broadway a number of times. James Joyce's The Dead in 2000, and then most recently a Music in the Air at City Center's Encore series. You've moved to New York?
Yes, I moved to New York from actually Seattle. I was a native Los Angeles person, and then in the 70s I moved up to Seattle to sing with the opera company, and then after that in the 80s I moved to New York and have been doing Broadway shows. And you have to travel from wherever you are anyway.
But I'm interested in how you maintain your voice, because some people do sing throughout their career. Others lose it in their 30s or 40s. Have you done something special?
Well, I think it was because I started teaching very early, and I tried to figure out scientifically also what was going on vocally. And because I could read music a lot, I could start to – I was hired sometimes to do things that I really couldn't do vocally, but they could trust me that I could sing the notes. But I then had to scurry around and go to vocal scientists and kind of learn what I was doing, and then just to try to describe it for other people makes it very helpful.
Well, you'll have a chance to see or hear Marnie Nixon in action at the Film Forum, because a number of different films that she has ghosted in will be screened in the upcoming days. But tonight, actually, there'll be a tribute to her starting at 7:30 at the Film Forum at 209 West Houston Street. For tickets and more details, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for coming by again.
Well, thank you so much.
On a bright cloud of music, shall we fly? Shall we dance? Shall we then say goodnight and mean goodbye? Or perchance, when the last little star has left the sky, shall we still be together with our arms around each other? And shall you be my new romance? On the clear understanding that this kind of thing can happen, shall we dance? Shall we dance? Shall we dance?